This is Captain Frank Mummert with the Maryland School of Sailing and Seamanship. Welcome to this edition of our podcast, Serious School, Serious Sailing. In tonight's podcast, Captain Tom Tersey and I will be discussing anchoring, some of the stuff we've learned over the years that will help you sleep at night when you're on the anchor. So, let's get started.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to tonight's discussion. Glad to have you all here. I find it interesting that somebody would say, would tell me to smile, because anybody who's ever sailed with me knows that laughing is my big thing. So, good evening. We're going to be talking about anchoring tonight. And I want to start out by talking about, oddly enough, when I do 104 classes here in the Chester River area, when we do 104s, I always come back to the Chester River, and I have four different areas that I can anchor in that I will not actually make the decision about where to anchor with my crew until pretty much the afternoon that we're heading up toward the anchorage areas. And basically what I have is I have a large open area with a very flat bottom that is about 7 feet deep through the entire area. And it's very well protected from the north and the east, but it's fairly open from the south and the west. And then there's a second area up on the Corsica River that is protected all the way around, but it's really tricky to get into because it's a very narrow channel and it's not well marked. And then there's a third area up in Gray's Inn Creek where it's well protected from the southwest and the northeast, but it's fairly open. But again, this is one of those that's not really well marked. So it's a good area there's not a lot of current point of view, but it can be a little tricky if the wind shifts to the wrong direction, we run the risk of going aground. And then the fourth area is actually out in the Chester River itself, where there's a lot of areas in there where you can just pull off the main channel and anchor. And it's nice, it's open, it's far away from the land, so there's not a lot of problems with bugs. You can get out of the main channel, but there's not a lot of protection from bad weather. So which one we use each time is going to be dependent upon the characteristics of wind and current and weather temperature. And actually, one of the things that's an issue is what day of the week is it? Because that anchorage area up in Gray's Inn Creek Landing, or Gray's Inn Creek, there's a marina up from there. And on the weekends, there tends to be a significant amount of small boat traffic coming in and out of there early in the morning and late in the evening. And that may be an issue that we didn't see if we were anchoring there on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. So when we're talking tonight, we're going to start by talking about what are the things that make a good anchorage for us, and then get into kind of what are the tools that we're going to use for that. So as I said, the things that I take into consideration are wind and current and how bad the bugs are and how much traffic we're going to see, things like that. Tom, can you, is there anything else that comes to mind in something that you would, that would be important in how you would choose a marine, an anchorage?
Oh yeah, Frank, there's a lot of additional considerations in addition to what you mentioned. And of course, one of them is the bottom. You mentioned depth very briefly, but the bottom, what is it composed of? Is it mud, like most of the Chesapeake Bay is? or is it rock, like up in the New England area? And that makes a big difference from the standpoint of if you break free, if you drag anchor, what are you going to run into? You run into more mud, or you going to run into some rocks? And I do remember seeing a video of an island packet, a big island packet down in the Caribbean. It ended up grounding on some rocks, and it just got pounded. That boat just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller as chunks fell off of it. So a big issue is, what is the bottom composed of? And the other part of the bottom issue is, well, what are the depths, and how large is the area available to you that the boat can swing in? And related to that is the scope of anchor that you have to put out. You mentioned weather forecasting and so forth. And if we're expecting strong winds or strong currents tonight, and I have to put out some additional scope because I feel like I'm dragging, do I have enough room to do that? And a related issue to that is other boats that may be anchored in the marina. And if I have other boats similar to mine where I'm anchored, and we all swing similarly, there's no problem. But if I'm right next to a catamaran, which is going to, or a power boat with different draft than I have, they're going to swing differently. And is there a chance that I could, with a wind change, swing into those other boats? So those are just a couple of the additional things that I think about in choosing an anchorage.
Yeah, I remember being down in Vero Beach in Florida and being in a mooring field, which is obviously similar to an anchorage area. And the wind tends to, in that area, tended to be fairly consistent. So boats that were affected by the wind tended to stay in one position. But obviously, the tide pattern would shift during the day. And I can remember at one point being down there. And the boats, there was a catamaran off the stern of a big sailboat, and when the winds and currents were in opposition, so that the catamaran was sitting one way and the sailboat was or the monohull was sitting the other way, you could actually step from the transom of the powerboat onto the transom of the catamaran. And that can be a little, it's one thing if you're doing that in a mooring field where everything's pretty well set, but doing that on an anchorage can be really tricky.
Yeah, no letting out scope in that condition, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But related to this, while we're on neighboring boats, there's also the issue of courtesies between boats. And basically, one of the basic courtesies is that the boat that's anchored there first has basically precedence, if you will. Another boat coming in after you have anchored, or if you're coming in after someone else is already in there, you have the obligation to anchor in such a location and manner that you're not going to obstruct them or be a hazard to them. So courtesy between boats is, I think, a very important issue as well.
I agree completely, although I will say that it has happened once in my career that we came in and we anchored. I thought we were anchored far enough from another boat, but the couple on the other boat came out and glared at us for about 10 minutes and then up anchored and moved. And on the one side, I was like, you know what? I feel bad because they were here first, but sometimes, if you're the first boat and somebody else is not in the position you want them to be in, you sometimes the only answer is up anchor and move.
Yeah, one of the safe things to do generally, if you have the room, is if there's a boat in there that's similar to yours, in other words, let's say a sailboat that's deep draft boat, and you're both going to swing in a similar manner. I find it effective to pull up close to the stern of that boat, drop my anchor at that point, and then back off, back away from that. So I'm scoped out quite a distance from that boat. Now, if we both swing, his anchor is already 100 feet or so ahead of his boat, And my anchor's 100 feet or so ahead of my boat. So if we swing in a similar manner, we generally don't have a problem. But there is a problem if it ends up being a catamaran, you know, which is an issue.
Yeah, unless you happen to be on a catamaran too.
Yeah, right. Right, right.
We talked earlier today about anchors, and you had some thoughts about anchors, the types of anchors.
Oh, I just want to show a picture so that if we have some discussions on this, we'll know what we're talking about. I just have to, you don't see my
Not yet. You haven't shared.
right? Yeah, so I have to share that. I have to share that. You now see a Danforth anchor?
I do see a Danforth anchor.
Okay, so generally this is called a lightweight anchor, Danforth. There's many variations of the basic Danforth anchor, but it's a lightweight, it's a fairly heavy duty sheet metal, but it's not a cast or forged anchor, so it's fairly light generally. They tend to be large also because they have large flukes on them, and the idea is that they do bite in well. They're pretty good for, as stated here, mud and sand, and they have pretty good strong holding power. So that's a basic lightweight anchor. Then this is a plow anchor, basic plow, also good in mud and sand. It's got strong holding power, easily releasable. And one of the things you can do, since this anchor is so rugged, is if it is stuck in and you're not able to raise it up, you know, out of the mud, not able to break it free, you can basically shorten up your scope, run up over the anchor with engine on, and then keep going forward. And basically, you can upend the anchor and unlatch it from the bottom, if you will. They're rugged anchors. I like the basic plow. Then there's a couple of variations to that. There's the Delta plow, which has an articulated joint there. And then there's this one that has the arch on it that's supposed to be prevented from laying on its back, you know, inadvertently. But they're basically plows. Those last three are all plows. And then there's the claw, which is good for mud, rocks, and sand and weeds. It's also a rugged anchor, but it's probably not the best all-around utility anchor, I would say. So, just for purposes of illustrating the basic types, there's a lot of variations. You know, everybody, people every day invent a new variation of anchor or anchor configuration. But I just wanted to
Yeah.
show the basic one. So here's the claw and the basic plow with the arch bar on it, Delta plow, and then the basic plow, and then the lightweight Danforth.
Yeah, I one of the things I as you know, Tom, we have a policy on the boat that we have no discussions of politics or religion. And I always tell students that I'm going to add politics, religion, or anchors. And in an emergency, I will allow politics or religion. But the thing about anchors is an anchor decision is a lot like religion, because in most cases, you can't see what the anchor is doing. You don't know what it's doing. And you have absolute faith that it's doing what it's supposed to do until it doesn't. And then you'll never trust it again.
Well, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to go on to a different subject. I
Well, I.
noticed that all of the plows had holes up in the front of the anchor.
Oh, yes. Yes. So you can add a float there on a line, and you can also use that as a trip line, basically, to haul the anchor up. But if you have a dug-in plow deep in the mud, I don't know if you're going to manually haul it out in that direction. That's the only thing. But that brings up another point about setting the anchor. And obviously, you know, in one case, you might have just manual roads. You don't have a windlass. And in the other case, you have a windlass. Now, I personally love having a windlass that I can operate with my plow anchor. I love the plow anchor and I love the windlass. But if you have 100 feet of chain on the windlass, and you have to crank that up, doing it manually at my aging stage in life, I really don't want to manually bring them up. So cranking it up with the windlass is my basic, my cup of tea, if you will. But there's an important point here, and that is not to put the strain, let's say it's blowing 15 knots and you're going to raise your anchor. You don't want to be pulling the strain of the road when it's under tension up with the windlass. You want to motor the boat up to put some slack in the chain and then crank the chain in with the windlass when it's slack. But also related to that is the idea of setting the, dropping the, I'll say dropping, I don't like the term, because I believe that dropping the anchor, which some people unlatch the clutch and let it free fall, and then you have the chain rolling out at a very high speed, and then the anchor hits the bottom, the chain ends up getting wrapped around the anchor, and you got problems. So I like to lower the anchor, if you will. And when it touches the bottom, then I want to just very, very slowly back away. And I'm going to do that at very minimal throttle setting on my engine. And then once I get a decent amount of scope out, depending on water depth, then my practice is to very, very gently keep the engine in reverse and let the anchor nestle its way down into the mud, and do that for a while, a couple of minutes, 5 minutes maybe. And then when I feel it's pretty well set in, then I might give it a yank to see that, a yank with the engine to see that it's in fact tight. And then I have to verify. So.
Well, yeah, I had a similar technique. I tend to let the boat drift back using wind and current rather than engine power, because one of the problems I always had with my own boat was I had a lot of prop walk, and so going even in a slow reverse, I would have a tendency to curl around the road, and so I usually found that it was better to just drift back with the tide and current until I had about half to two thirds of the scope out, and then set it with the engine. But
And
I think
you had a story about backing up and going around on prop warp, didn't you?
I did when very early when we first started cruising, Suzanne and I first started cruising. We were anchoring just south of Koinjock, North Carolina, in a very small anchorage area. It was probably only there was enough room for maybe two boats, and we were there and it was 50-degree water temperature, 55-degree air temperature. Now I always put a trip on my I always put a float and a trip on my anchor, on my plow anchor, because I want to know where the anchor is. And that's the other thing that a float will tell you is where the actual anchor is. And I had we had dropped the excuse me, dropped the anchor, but had a little bit too much scope on the float. The float had not settled yet, and when we started to back, we backed over the float and picked it up in the propeller. And I started out by trying to cut it free using a steak knife duct taped to a boat hook from the dinghy. And by the way, that is not a good idea. There's a lot of things that can go wrong there. But I ended up the next morning before we got underway having to put on a wetsuit and dive over the side in order to cut enough of that line off the propeller to get us moving again. So yeah, it's a really good idea to have a float. Like I said, I always had a float, but after that, I always had a polypropylene float line, which probably was not going to be the greatest thing for pulling the anchor back up, but it definitely made it a whole lot easier to not run over it. So you pays your nickel, you takes your chances.
Yeah, one of the other things that you have to consider after you have set the anchor and you're kind of satisfied with that is to get a fix on your position and a GPS fix you can use, but I mean, I like to do a visual fix. And basically, I look for objects ashore in which I can align two objects, like maybe there are two tall pine trees that line up in a certain way. Maybe there's a lamppost on a street nearby that lines up with something else. So I try to get two ranges like that where I can visually sight those two palm trees, pine trees, and sight the lamppost on the building, if you will, and just make sure that they stay the same. Now, granted, once then it becomes dark, and you cannot see those things, so you may not have the benefit of that ranging. So in that case, a GPS fix is a good thing, and you can also set an anchor watch on your GPS, and you can specify the diameter of the watch circle to make sure you're not dragging.
Yeah, I my policy on my own boat was when I put the anchor, I first off, if I put the anchor down at the end of the day we were going to be traveling, what I would do is once the anchor was down and we were set, I would go down, get myself a glass of wine, small glass of wine, and come back up and just sit and watch while I enjoyed my glass of wine. And if everything was still stable after the 10 or 15 minutes I sat there, then I was fairly sure we were in good shape. And that it forced me to sit and take some time to actually watch things.
But if you weren't sure, you got another glass of wine and sat there again. And
No.
then things started looking pretty good to you, right?
No, I had a crew member who was fundamentally opposed to me having more than the one glass of wine. And that actually leads into another thing. We did use GPS watches on our Suzanne had one on her phone. She had Drag Queen, I think, on her phone, and I used Aquamaps on my iPad, and we would both set them separately and keep them both running during the night, because that way there were two independent systems watching to see if we drug. And particularly the Navionics one, I could wake up in the middle of the night, look at that, and see exactly where we had been for the last 10 hours. And it was always interesting to me because it created what I called a dog bone pattern, because the anchor would be in the middle and we would be stretched out, and then we would kind of wiggle back and forth and make a line with a ball at the end of it. And then when the current changed, because everywhere we went, we were tidal. When the current changed, we would get up 180 degrees out the other way, and then that same thing would happen. So we would have two balls with a bar in the middle, kind of like a dog bone, a classic cartoon dog bone. But yeah, you sleep a whole lot better when you have a system in place to know whether or not you're dragging.
Well, I recall being one time anchored in Fishing Bay. In fact, Rita, I think you were with me at that time. And I got up in the middle of the night just to check things out. And I looked out the companionway, and there was a boat like 20 feet from us, a big power boat, about 20 feet from us. And I saw some activity rustling around on it. Obviously, wind had come up. And obviously, these people dragged from way across the bay to right next to us, and fortunately, we didn't get hit by that. But it is a good idea to get up a couple of times and check, how do things look out there, especially if the wind comes up, or if the wind direction changes, or if the current direction changes. But you can get all that in the forecast, so I think it's vital to know what your weather forecast is for the overnight hours, in terms of the wind, the current, the water depth. How low is that water depth likely to be? How deep is the water likely to be? In other words, do I have enough scope? If I'm in an area where I have a tidal swing of, let's say, 8 or 9 feet, did I put enough scope out for that water depth? You might have anchored in 6 feet, and then it goes up to 20 feet or 15 feet. You got to make sure you do that. And the thing related to that is the scopes. I mean, generally, what they recommend for scope is if you have a rope and chain row, like about 20 feet of chain and the rest rope, they generally recommend 7 to 1, normally seven times the water depth. And if you have chain, all chain, generally recommend 4 times. Now, if the wind is going to come up, you of course want to increase these lengths, because the longer the scope you have, the more likelihood that the anchor will bite in better.
Yeah, and then some of the additional tools you can use are like putting a kellet, a weight on the chain. And that's one of the nice things about a chain is you can actually shackle things right to that and hold it at that point. That weight helps to keep the chain more flat and keeps more pressure on holding you in place.
Well, explain that a little bit more, Frank. So you're putting that weight, that kellet, a part way down the anchor rod, maybe 2/3 of the way down, so that it pulls the lower portion of the chain parallel to the ground, basically, and gives you a better direction of pull.
Exactly. One of the things I used to do when I was in places like southern South Carolina and Georgia, where there's a huge tidal range. And the thing about a huge tidal range is it means that the flow rate is going to be greater. If you're gonna change the depth by 10, 15 feet, that's a lot of water moving in and out. So if you look at this and you go, well, I got a 10-foot tidal range here, you need to be aware that you're going to have a lot of water flow.
Strong current.
And one of the things we would do is we would put now I had an all chain road, so we would put out about 25 feet of chain on our main rockna. We had a 75 kilogram rockna, and then at that point I would shackle on a lightweight Danforth with about 6 feet of chain. So it's shackled to the same chain, and then go ahead and lay out the rest of the chain, which is usually at that point about 100 feet, 150 feet, because we know we're going to have a big tidal range.
How
And
far did
mostly,
you put the Danforth from the anchor?
usually, like, let's say we're in 20 feet of water. So what we do is we'd put down the Danforth. Or I'm sorry, we put down the Rockna. Okay, that's 20 feet. Then we'd let out another 20 feet and drift back. So now I got 40 feet of chain out. Now I'll go ahead and put on the Danforth. So it's about 20 feet from the original from the first anchor, from the primary anchor. And
And
so
then
what it's doing,
you might be putting another 60 feet
I'll put
in.
out, yeah, at that point there's another 70, 60 to 100 feet, depending on how much I expect to see tidal range.
Yeah.
But and again, I've got a float on the primary anchor, so I know exactly where the primary anchor is, and I know where I am when I drop that secondary anchor.
Yeah.
Now, coming back to your windlass story. We were in Georgia in a little creek off the South Mud River, and my windlass failed and would not bring the anchor up. And I had to bring that anchor. What I ended up doing was running a line from the winch on the main mast out to the road, hooking onto the road at the bow roller, and then cranking in, and then going up and snubbing that and doing that over and over again to bring in that 150 feet. And you're right, that was an hour and 10 minutes to bring that in, and I was exhausted by the time I was done. You do not want to do that too many times.
Yeah, well, that brings up the topic of chain hooks and snubbers.
Yep.
So, in doing what you did, you know, now no doubt had a chain hook designed for the size of your anchor chain,
Absolutely.
and you're able to hook it into that chain efficiently. But that same hook is used in the snubber, which basically is intended to take the load off of your windlass. So once you have your anchor set, you're happy with the set of the anchor, you take your snubber, hook it onto the chain just ahead of your bow rollers, cleat it on your bow cleat there, and then let out some more chain until the snubber line is taking all the load, and that the chain coming into the windlass is slack, actually.
Yeah. And I did that. I had a about a 30-foot long snubber line with a chain hook at the end of it that I did exactly that. I would hook it into a link on the chain, let it out, and then cleat the line. So I had about 25 feet of nylon road in there to take that pressure off. The only two things, one thing that I know and one thing that I've heard, the one thing that I know is that when you're doing that, you got to keep some tension on that hook, because I've had it where you get about 30 feet, you get, 10, 15 feet of that line out, and the hook lets go of the chain, and you got to pull it all back in and start
It
again.
drops off, right?
And the other thing I've heard, and I don't know, I don't have enough experience to know whether or not this is actually a real problem, is I've had people say that you have to be careful with a chain hook because it point loads the anchor chain and creates a tension point at one link, where if you took a rolling hitch on the if you just took the line and did a rolling hitch onto the chain, then you're going to spread that tension out over a longer distance.
Yeah.
I personally never had that issue, so I just used the hook. I was perfectly happy with the hook. And the other thing is, I have tried to tie a rolling hitch to a chain, and it never works as well as it looks in the pretty pictures. Well, Tom, we're coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to start looking at some of these questions. You want to say anything while I find questions?
Yeah, go ahead. Get your next questions. So, the other thing that I would comment on is that when you're raising the anchor, I alluded to this briefly before, is that you do not want to go putting the road tension onto the windlass, and you do want to have the person at the helm be in very good communication with hand signals between the bow and cockpit on coming up. And the road is playing out to starboard, or it's playing out to port, or it's playing out straight ahead. But basically, you want to take the tension off of the road as you crank in with your windlass. And of course, if you're doing it by hand, as Frank just did, you definitely want to get the load off of that road.
All right, I got a question here. Any thoughts about sailing at anchor, possible solutions? And then a related thing, we've been using a riding sail when at anchor for the past couple of years. Do you have an opinion on benefits or downsides of that?
Well, I'm assuming he means a riding sail in order to prevent the boat from
Yeah, these are
backing.
actually two different comments, so yeah.
Yeah.
Now I had a catch, so it I would set the it, if I had issues with sailing around on the anchor, I would just put up the mizzen sail, and that would hold us into the wind.
I've seen another configuration which I have not used, but I've seen it and I've talked to people about it. And basically that is having a triangular piece of canvas with the three corners, grommets in all three corners, and you take your halyard into the top corner of it, and then your two lower corners you lash off to your stern cleats, and basically you have a triangle athwart ship, and that's intended to work as a riding sail. I myself have not used it, but I understand effective.
Yeah. I and the thought about sailing at anchor, I've had it happen occasionally. To me, it tends to be a very specific wind and weather combination. I think one of the things that you can do, one of the other things you can do besides putting out a riding sail, is to bring if you got a chain or you got a second line you can attach to your anchor rod, bring it up the side of the boat so that the boat actually sits not directly into the current, not directly into the wind, but at a slight angle so that it keeps some pressure on.
Like the party brattle that we use on sea anchor.
There you go. What, how about local regulations? There are places which are protected by local law for whatever reason. There's a situation going on in Florida right now, particularly in the Miami Beach area, where they are trying to pass laws at the state level that will give the local governments the ability to just ban anchoring. And usually what they do is they say, oh, well, you can anchor wherever you want as long as you're 1,000 feet from the shore and 1,000 feet from anything else and 1,000 feet from the. And by the time you get done with this, there's like a 7 square foot area.
Well,
And.
there's no question about the fact that locals do not like to see transients anchoring in their waters.
I, that it.
So
Yeah,
you're generally not welcome.
if you've paid $1 million for your view and there's some guy in a $100,000 sailboat out there with the same view, that just irritates people. And the other problem, and I saw this down in Fort Pierce, where the problem is the people who live ashore have access to the local government, where the people who are just anchoring in transient. They're not going to be there long enough to actually fight any of this. So a lot of these anchoring laws tend to get into place because of that. I will say that Boat US, Boat Owners Association of the United States, Boat US, started out as a political action
Organization.
committee to work against things like anchoring laws. So, if you want to keep anchoring possibilities, I highly suggest getting being involved with Boat US. They are very good at that.
Well, that related to that is the fact that you have to be respectful of local ordinances, and in pretty much all cases now, you cannot dump waste overboard.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
you have to be very cognizant of that. So you have to make sure that your holding tank has capacity in it. If you came in full, you have to find a place to get pumped out properly. And you have to be respectful of the locals that you are the visitor to their waters,
Yep.
and you have to respect that.
What anchor is best for rocky bottoms? How do they roll? How do they hold their ground, and how do they release?
The claw is basically used for rocks and coral and things like that. You're not supposed to anchor in coral, right? But yeah, but the claw anchor that I showed you is intended for rocks and rocky configurations.
Yeah, I think the other anchor that tends to get tends to get called up in big rock situations is the classic yachtsman anchor, what I refer to as the Popeye anchor. It's the one that looks like a tattoo with the straight line and the curved part,
Right.
and basically that's just a little point that kind of digs in between a couple of rocks, and those. I've only used that once, and the only way you're getting that back up is by the trip line, because once it's in, you've got to pull it the other direction. Any thoughts on the forged Danforth anchors from the 1940s compared to the newer Danforth aluminum ones? I have one of each. Both versions are able to be disassembled and stored in three places or three pieces. That's sorry, three places. Yeah, I keep this part of the anchor in the bow, and I keep this part of the anchor in the stern, three pieces.
Well, so he's talking about the fortress, right? The
Yeah,
company
yep.
part? Yeah. Well, I mean that's a large storm anchor, basically. At one time in my life, I used to carry an anchor like that for have it disassembled and so forth. But it's a good thing depending on where you're going to be sailing and where you're going to be anchoring. So it's a
Yeah,
good
I
item
think
to have.
I had that same big anchor that disassembled and I kept in the bilge for conditions that I never wanted to be in. I will say that I have bent Danforth anchor flukes in the aluminum ones where I think the forged Danforth ones don't bend as easily. So.
I don't think I'd want an aluminum anchor at all.
Well, the high tensiles aren't too bad, but yeah, it's much. I I had a Rachna. I loved my Rachna. They would have had to dig that thing out of my cold, dead hands. I definitely, because that was the only way I slept on a regular basis. Chain versus fiber road. Fiber is fragile in coral environments. Yeah, fiber's fragile in a lot of environments. I've actually seen nylon road get damaged by shells on the bottom. If you're in an area where there's a lot of shells, I've seen it get scraped up by the shells. I definitely was a chain guy. Now, the downside of chain is it weighs a lot and it's harder to replace. I mean, pretty much anywhere you go, you can buy 150 feet of nylon road.
Yeah, and the thing about chain, of course, it's going to add weight to the bow of your boat. It's going to bring your bow down. So you're kind of limited somewhat on how much chain you can carry. I personally, I love chain. I love chain. I love the windlass, but I understand there's a limitation. So you might have 100 or 150 feet of chain, and then the rest of it be a fiber rope.
What is better, a D shackle or a swivel for connecting the anchor to the chain? I was a D shackle guy. Particularly since I had a lot of chain, the chain had the ability to adjust.
If you're on a rope road, you prop a three strand rope, you probably need a swivel, because as that rope road tensions and releases tension, it can twist, and that could be fatiguing factor for the line. Could it also end up knotting up, but I think the swivel is intended to resist that temptation.
Yeah, the only thing is that I've heard some, obviously a D shackle is going to hold, there's less danger of a D shackle falling apart where a swivel has some, because it's a mechanical fitting, it has some issues there.
Well, the D shackle, if you're using one, should have an upset mushroom there as opposed to just a friction pole, right? But
Well, we seized it with, we moused it with wire.
yeah.
I always thought you were supposed to set the GPS fix as soon as the anchor touched bottom and took a bite. What we did, both of the GPS systems we had allowed you to say the anchor is this far away in this direction. After we set the anchor again, because I got the float out there, I know where the anchor is. So I would simply say the anchor is 200 feet away on compass on true bearing 350, and that would generally tell me that would generally set that as the point that the anchor was that the swing circle was going to be addressed around. Do you have any comments on that, Tom?
No, I think that's fine. I see that there's another question here about anchor lights, and I know there's always the question of do I turn the anchor light on, do I not?
Ah.
And technically, if you're in a designated anchorage area, you don't need an anchor light. But if it's not a designated anchorage per se, you do. That's my understanding, basically.
And I one of the things about anchor lights, almost all sailboats have a masthead light. And the problem I have seen with masthead lights, particularly if you're in a dark, dark anchorage and there's a starry, starry field up there, it's sometimes difficult to pick out the anchor light. And particularly if you're someplace where power boats could be moving around, they're not looking 50 feet up in the air. So I always had my anchor lights were down at deck level. I had one forward and one aft so that I got 360 degrees, because it doesn't say you have to have 360 degrees from a single light. In fact, the actual rule is you need a forward and an aft light on boats smaller than, I'm going to say 65 feet, but it could be 40 feet, you can have a single light. Might be 150 feet. I think maybe 50 meters. But anyway, you're allowed to go to a single light, but you can have as many anchor lights as you want. And lighting up the boat's deck is a whole lot better than lighting up the top of the mast 50 feet in the air.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with the anchor light at the top of the mast. The fact that you're coming back to your boat and digging, you're trying to find your anchor light. It's way up there. It looks like a star.
Yeah. Do the two anchor ranges work even when swinging? I suppose not. There's going to be a certain amount of adjustment. A lot of it's going to depend on how far you are from the two range marks. If the two range marks are 3/4 of a mile away, you're swinging 150 feet either direction, not going to make a big difference. How do sailors historically and currently set the anchor without an engine? Also, if the anchor gets stuck, can you release it without the engine if necessary? Usually tide and current. Tide and current set your anchor. And you got to remember that for a particularly historically, the way you made sure that you weren't dragging was you put a bunch of guys on deck and said, "You guys keep an eye out." You had an anchor watch around 24/7. Getting the If the anchor gets stuck, can you release it without the engine if necessary?
Well, that's where the trip line comes in.
Trip line. I have on a small boat, I have seen people sail back and forth at about a 45-degree angle and tack back and 45 and tack back and try to work the anchor out that way.
Well, that's to break it free, right?
I do know that I want to say Tom Cunliffe. I don't remember what I read this 25 years ago. He used to talk about what he would do is he would bring the anchor tight directly under the bow and then make himself a cup of tea. And while he was making the cup of tea, the boat, by its movement up and down and back and forth in the waves, would break the anchor free. Now, I think you probably need to keep a close eye on what the boat's doing while you're doing that, because if that anchor comes up while you're down below making a cup of tea, you may be moving through the anchorage a little bit more than you want to.
We did something similar to that in Bermuda several years ago, where we were in Bermuda tied up alongside when a hurricane came through. And during the height of the storm, I was getting concerned about our bow being blown off in one direction, because the winds were at this point pretty much cross ship, thwart ship. And so I put the anchor out while we're tied up at the dock, just as an additional insurance in case we broke a dock line or what have you. And then the storm passed. Day later, we went to pull the anchor up. We couldn't get it out of the bottom. I mean, just no way to get it out of the bottom. So we pulled the road in as tight as we could, cleared it off, and went about our business. We had students come aboard. We were starting our onboard training. And all of a sudden, several hours later, the bow of the boat just went pop, just popped out as the tide changed, as the tide level changed, just popped up. So,
So yes, you can get the anchor up without an engine. May not be when you expect it to. Are there situations where it's bad to use a snubber? I can't think of one. I can't think.
I personally would always use a snubber.
Yeah, I would because the thing is that if you have an all chain road and that chain becomes tight, that's an iron bar. You are now anchored to the bottom by an iron bar, and that is not a good thing for you or the boat. In storm conditions, would you prefer placing a second anchor at a 45-degree angle to the primary anchor, or one bow anchor and one stern anchor?
I personally, I don't like two anchors out, only because the road, if the storm is wind conditions are going back and forth or current, whatever, those two roads end up getting tangled to one another. Then I have a hell of a time getting them up. If I was uncomfortable with my anchor, my single anchor that was out, and I wanted additional security, I would run the engine all night and take some load off of the anchor.
Yeah, in the 104 classes we teach, because it's part of the curriculum, we teach how to do a forked moor, which is 45 degrees, or how to do what's called a Bahamian moor, where you have two anchors off the bow at 180 degrees, one up current and one down current. On my own boat, as I said, I always used to say, if I was going to use a second anchor, I would chain it to the first anchor to act as a kellet. I will tell you that very, very early, actually 2 or 3 days after we succeeded in running over our trip line, we were in a situation where we were in a creek that was about 150 feet wide, and we were anchored in the middle of the creek. And because I was worried about swinging to one side or the other, I set out a stern anchor. And when the current started to change, the boat swung onto both anchors. They were both going upriver, and we were being held side to across the creek. And again, there's a lot of water flow when you got a 15 degree or 15 foot tidal change. And I ended up having to cut the second, I had to buoy the second anchor, the stern anchor, cut it free, and then bring it up separately in the morning. I really think a bow anchor and a stern anchor are a bad idea.
Frank, there's another question on snubber.
You're reading ahead of me. Okay, go ahead.
I can't see it now. It disappeared from me.
Okay, hold on. How do you set the anchor alarm using Navionics? I don't know. Can you walk through how you set two anchors? Like I said, that's a 104 skill. And I'm going to come back. Comments on single-handed raising anchor on an unfortunate lee shore. I have never done it myself, but I have friends who I have watched bring up an anchor single-handed. Basically, what they did in a situation where they were on a lee shore is they brought the anchor up as tight as possible, manually, with the engine running in slow ahead. And then as they got close, they ran back and they knocked the boat out of gear and then snubbed the anchor up tight and then ran forward over it to pop it out. And then when they came off, now they're dragging the anchor as they're moving forward. Once they were about 35, 45 feet forward, they would quickly run up and try to pull the anchor back up with the boat in gear and the autopilot heading them out. You can do it. Single-handed sailing to me is always a this is what's going to go wrong kind of situation. Please say more about the different swing of cats compared to monohulls. You want to handle that one, Tom?
Well, yeah, I mean, the catamaran being shallow draft is going to, if there's a wind change or a current change, it's going to swing sooner than a deeper draft monohull. So just a question of the timing. Eventually, both boats are going to be heading in the same direction once things settle out. But in the interim, in the transition of wind or current, the shallow draft catamaran is going to go sooner. Likewise,
And
a power boat, generally being shallower draft, is going to go sooner.
yeah, a fin keel, a full keel is going to hold more toward the current. Fin keel is going to move a little bit more toward the wind. Monohull or catamaran, power boat, and then small keel boat. All of those are going to be more affected by wind than current. How valuable are the anchor selection charts based on boat size alone? Generally speaking, what I've always heard and what I personally went with is whatever it said, I went one size bigger than that.
Yeah, pretty much anything on that score. Let me mention at this point then, West Marine on their website has an excellent anchoring series of articles, and you might check those out. It goes into a lot of different aspects of anchoring and anchoring equipment and anchors, chains, splices, and all that sort of a thing. So check that out for some good information.
Yeah. For anchorages where the wind or current is not in line with waves, how about using a preventer from the road to a mid cleat to orient the bow into the waves? Yeah, we were talking about that earlier, that
Bridle.
if you're having trouble with that, bridling the main and then coming down the side and shifting the boat out a little bit is an excellent idea.
Yeah, what that involves is bringing a line from the anchor road to, let's say, your stern cleat, or to your winch in your cockpit if you have a aft cockpit boat. And crank in on that. So what you would do is tie a rolling hitch 10 or 15 feet out from your bow on the road. You can tie it near your bow and then let out 10 or 15 feet, and then take the inboard end of that line and bring it up to your winch, crank the winch, and turn the boat that way.
Do you use the Rule 30 black ball at anchor? When I was in Australia last year, all their training books show them. Not a single ASA textbook, however, shows those are used. As a matter of fact, I did. You remember I said that I had two anchor lights, one forward and one aft. That black ball is supposed to be in your fore triangle. And basically, what I did is I attached my forward light to the bottom of the black ball, and then hung that on my head sail, so that it was in the forepeak. Yeah, I have, with the exception of commercial vessels, I can't tell you that I've ever seen it more than three times in the entire in the entire time I was boating. Never see them.
Not in the US, no.
Yeah, it's interested in the difference between catamarans and monohull vessels swinging at anchor. I think we've discussed that. I've anchored in thunderstorms and have been lucky. Any ideas on what to do emergency-wise if you find your anchor's not holding and you're a slave to the high winds cruising across the bay out of control? Yeah, been there, done that. The only thing you can do is, as Tom said, you got to keep the engine running and just try to keep the bow into the wind, and get the anchor up. Because you do not want to be in a situation where that anchor's hanging down and the engine is running, because you will run over your own anchor and then your engine will stop and then you have three problems.
Well, and taking that a step further, if you're in those kind of conditions and you are going to haul the anchor, if you are going to haul the anchor up, as Frank is suggesting, I would just put up my deep reef main and basically sailboat.
I got hit once by a sailboat that dragged into me at night. Beware of losing the set of your anchor. We ended up dragging because we failed to reset the anchor. Yeah. If you've been hit, if somebody has run into you, it's put more stress on your anchor. There's a good chance you've pulled out. And the problem is that it may be pulled out halfway, and that was still okay for the conditions, but then 2 hours later, when the tide shifts or the current shifts, all of a sudden you got a problem. Give us a story about a broken road. I don't have any broken road stories. I have broken a lot of things, but I've never succeeded in breaking a chain road.
I don't have any stories on that either.
Obviously, we use our anchor light. However, are there navigation or other clues you recommend at anchor? For example, radar, AIS. We run our AIS always, but with recent stories of collision by passing vessels, I'm wondering, radar collision alarm along with anchor alarms. Those are good options. The problem, I think, with most of those is that Your AIS alarm or your radar alarm is going to be going off in your cockpit. And if you're sleeping in the V berth or like,
Frank, we don't hear you anymore.
I muted myself while I was talking. Basically, the problem to me is that all of those alarms are going to be in the cockpit, so you would need to rig a separate alarm to be in where your sleeping area is.
Well, the other comment I make on that is that setting those alarms, like the AIS alarm, every boat out there doesn't have it. AIS. So they may not be transmitting
Well,
or
and that's, I think that was the point about using the radar as well, is that the radar, although the thing about radar is that by the time somebody got close enough,
it's pretty iffy.
it, yeah.
But the point I wanted to make is any kind of an electronic alarm, whether it's radar or AIS, my view on that is if you feel that you are now protected, well protected, and you go to sleep well, I think you're mistaken. Because I think anytime it's overnight, you're not going to sleep well. You might sleep well for an hour, but you got to be up and down,
Yeah.
check. If you're really concerned, your best alarm is to have a crew member on duty. You know, if somebody's awakened in the cockpit, if conditions are bad or expected bad, somebody's got to be up.
Yeah, my rule of thumb is if we were anchored for a day, like we came in, we were going to anchor for a day. There was somebody on board the boat all the time. If one of us had to go ashore to get something like food or part or mail, somebody else, one of us stayed on board the boat all the time. We would not leave the boat unless we had been through five tide changes, so 2.5 days.
Frank, it's 8 o'clock. I think we ought to wrap up.
I got two more things real quick. You said you always use a snubber. Would you use a snubber even if you had both chain and rope? No. I would only use a snubber if I was using all chain,
Oh yeah, right.
because the nylon road is a snubber. Most charter boats don't have marks on road to no distance. Any hacks on how? Yeah, my favorite one is put a float on the anchor, and that way you know how far you are from the anchor, and that tells you what your distance is. All right. Well, that's about it. We want to thank everybody for being here tonight.
And that pretty much brings us to the end of another episode. We're looking forward to hearing from you at office@mdschool.com. Please put chat in the subject line and give us some feedback on how we're doing. We'd appreciate hearing from you, and we look forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks.